Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the MondoWise podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At MondoWise, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. In this episode, we have a conversation with Wissam Sharaf, an advocate with the Civil and Political Rights Unit at Adela, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. MondoWise Palestine correspondent Yumna Patel sat down with Wissam to discuss what life has been like for Palestinian citizens of Israel over the past 2 months. In May, Palestinian citizens of Israel participated in massive protests and boycotts as part of the Unity Uprisings, in what many Palestinians have described as the largest display of unity in years. In the wake of the protests, Palestinian citizens of Israel have continued to be arrested en masse and jailed. Despite this, Wissam and other advocates say that air of resistance in Palestinian communities in Israel remains strong.
So joining us today is Wissam Sharaf, a human rights advocate and full-time attorney with Adela, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. In addition to his work as a teaching and research assistant in international law at Haifa University, Wissam is also an activist in his hometown in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. Wissam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Yumna.
So, you know, today we're going to be discussing sort of the events of last month that we saw and what many people deemed as the Unity Uprisings. Particularly, we'd like to speak to you about the participation of Palestinian citizens in Israel, who for the purpose of this conversation, we're going to be referring to a lot as 48 Palestinians. Just so for our audience who maybe aren't familiar with that terminology, 48 Palestinians or Palestinians living in 48 are those, you know, almost 2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel, you know, those who are living within the borders of the state that was founded in 1948. So that's just a little clarification for our audience who might not be familiar with the terminology. So Wissam, I'd like to start off sort of going over the accounts of what happened last month. You know, we saw countless videos of Palestinians in places like Yafa, Haifa, and Dakka coming under attack from right-wing Israeli Jewish mobs. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like for Palestinians in 48 during those very, you know, tumultuous few weeks that we saw last month? And what was the atmosphere like? Could you just describe it for us?
The events of last month, it's first of all, there is a need to remind everyone that it was the last days of Ramadan. Just before Eid al-Fitr, everybody was preparing for celebratory evenings to celebrate the Eid and also to celebrate the end of Ramadan month. I have witnessed in all these days that have been very hard for a lot of Palestinians and Arabs living in cities like Yafa, Haifa, and Akka, and also Lid and Ramli, the cities that contain also Jewish citizens and also Arab citizens. The events are unprecedented. This clashes, these breaches, these attacks haven't been precedented in Palestine since 1929. During these evenings, when the right-wing mobs walked over in the streets searching for Arabs to lynch, it was a very scary moment for a lot of us living in a city that also contain Jewish and Arab citizens. Have always been challenging. You don't live the atmosphere of being Ghani, to have living in cities that contain also Jewish and also Arab citizens. Mm-hmm. Don't allow you to live your culture on a daily basis. So it's already challenging. And mm-hmm. to add to that, the feeling of not being secure, the fear for your life, and the fear for your property, have been scary feelings. These days have left their marks in all of us, I guess, searching for answers from the international community as well as the Israeli community about the myth of coexistence mm-hmm. in these cities. We have witnessed the police, the Israeli police, protecting and participating with the right-wing mobs. Mm-hmm. For example, in some cases that I have witnessed in my work as an attorney, people have been attacked. Police were there. Police were in the scene, and they asked the police's help, but they didn't provide that help, and they just let them for their fate. These events, what happened in the last days of Ramadan and Eid al-Fitr have left their marks on everyone living in these cities.
You know, there's something that you mentioned as well, you know, that this was the sort of actions and things that we were seeing in those last days of Ramadan and in those few weeks last month was sort of unprecedented. The last time that was sort of witnessed was in the late 1920s. And that was something that was being talked about a lot by Palestinians across the board, not just in 48, but in other parts of Palestine and the diaspora as well, was people were really paying attention to the levels of participation. You know, we saw widespread participation in protests across Palestinian cities and communities in 48. And these protests that we saw in Lidda, Ramla, and Haifa, and Yafa, and Akka, these seem to spark a huge sense of unity between Palestinians across all of Palestine and the diaspora. Could you just give us a little more insight into what were the protests like in 48 around that time? You know, who were the leaders of the protests? We heard a lot of talk that, you know, these protests were being led by youth and grassroots movements, et cetera. Do you feel like there was, you know, in addition to the very violent attacks that, that Palestinians in 48 were facing on themselves and on their property, do you feel like there was also something different about the protests that we saw this time than maybe we've witnessed in recent history in 48?
Protests of last May, I have witnessed that, yeah, and these protests have been mainly led by young people, the youth students of universities, schools, who have been subject to a lot of discriminatory policies by the Israeli state. And the spark that led to that was the attack on Al-Aqsa during the Laylat al-Qadr. This, yani, I have seen that the grassroots and also yani, young people taking in their initiatives and going out to the streets to protest all the discriminatory policies in Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, and also the attacks on Al-Aqsa as an extraordinary event. We are not familiar with this kind of protests, at least in the recent years. Most of the protests have been led by the political leadership of Palestinians in 48, the High Follow-Up Committee for Arabs in Israel. The political leadership also joined these protests, but the spark for these protests came from the youth. Mm-hmm. This actually gives a feeling of hope that with all the discriminatory policies that a Palestinian in 48 is subject to since birth, all the, I would call it mind-washing that the school students are subject to in schools didn't lead to a disconnect between the Palestinians in 48 and events that happened in Jerusalem or the West Bank or Gaza. On the contrary, it led to, as you described, a feeling of unity. And this also was felt in the streets. So the protests that were led by the youth mainly actually yani, gave the feeling that there is no disconnect between 48 and other parts of Palestine. Although they have been subject to a lot of mind-washing policies, discriminatory policies from the Israeli state to establish such a disconnection. This was also felt in the streets, in the protests themselves, with all the chants that the youth have been using in support of Gaza, in support of Jerusalem, in support of Sheikh Jarrah, that led to such a huge feeling of unity, of being a part of people. This haven't been the case in recent years. The protests have been scattered when something happened, when there is events, yani, the protests have been scattered, sometimes led by the political leadership that in 48. This time it was more comprehensive, I would say, for all of Palestinians in 48.
You know, you mentioned these protests sort of giving people a sense of hope. And I know from being in Palestine that something that did give people a lot of hope also was the massive levels of participation that we saw in 48 during the general strike that people called for on May 18. From your perspective and from what you witnessed, what were the levels of participation that you saw, you know, amongst Palestinians in 48? Was it as widespread as, you know, people understood it to be? Could you just sort of paint us a picture of how the general strike on May 18th may have affected, you know, Israeli society or the Israeli economy? You know, before I'll just give an example, maybe for those who are listening, there were reports that came out after the general strike on May 18th that because of the levels of participation that were witnessed, for example, amongst Palestinian laborers from the West Bank who work in construction inside Israel, many parts of, you know, the Israeli economy centered around construction were totally shut down. So I'm interested in hearing your point of view of of how participation was amongst 48 Palestinians on May 18th with the general strike?
First of all, I would like to mention that the strike as a means of protest is one of the most peaceful ways of demonstration that any person could imagine. It's just saying that I am not doing anything in protest of some policies. And also it gives a huge feeling of unity between the community itself, because being on strike doesn't only mean to affect the economy of the other side or also to demonstrate my views or to demonstrate my voice, but also means to strengthen the community. I witnessed a huge compelling with the call for the strike. There was a lot of people who didn't go to work, stores that closed their doors. I have witnessed a huge portion of participation in the strike, but what was unique about the strike of May 18th was the activities also led by the youth and the grassroots organizations being done in the streets of our villages and towns to also strengthen this feeling of a community and to educate and spread information to the younger generations about from the experience of the elders. This by itself was heartwarming and gave a huge feeling of unity and hope, as I mentioned before. I am pretty sure that all this have affected the economy, the Israeli economy, in a huge way. We have witnessed, I don't have exact numbers, but some press releases talked about millions of losses to the Israeli economy during only one day of strike. Mm-hmm. This also left huge mark on the employers themselves, who tried to pressure the employees, the Arab employees, to come to work. The sense of unity when everybody stood and said no, it also strengthened the employees' positions in front of the employers. I would like also to add that the strike of May 18th was a warning sign for the Israeli public. The people, the Palestinians of 48, are also part of all of Palestine. And their strike is such an effective way on your economy that you need to double check before proceeding forward with discriminatory policies and with the mass evacuations, with the attacking protesters, attacking Gaza, from the fear that it may come back again. A strike for weeks or months may lead to a financial crisis. This message was felt very strong also in the Israeli media, also in the streets.
You know, from your activities and your work on the ground, do you think that we might be seeing more actions like that and more efforts by organizers to call for more strikes in the future?
For the right reasons, I would see that as I mentioned before, the one of the most effective ways to protest, one of the most peaceful ways to protest, and one of the most useful for the community itself. So I would hope that this kind of free speech would come again in the future if the Israeli state would continue with its discriminatory policies against Palestinians.
A lot of the moments that we saw during the movement, you know, as people were characterizing it, right, as the unity uprisings and the massive levels of participation that we were seeing in 48 really did inspire, I think, a lot of hope amongst Palestinians, not just in Palestine, but, you know, in the diaspora and across the world as well. But, you know, since those uprisings that we sort of saw in May and after the ceasefire that was called in Gaza, we've seen that a lot of protests, you know, have since quote unquote quieted down. Obviously, things are by no means normal for Palestinians living under occupation or, you know, living under Israel's apartheid regime. But now, specifically in the immediate aftermath of these sort of protests, Palestinians especially 48 Palestinians, are facing another threat, which is Israel's sort of massive arrest campaign of Palestinian protesters to, as Israeli police have put it, quote, settle the score. Can you tell us more about what the climate's been like amongst, you know, Palestinian communities inside Israel as they sort of face this massive crackdown? What do they see as the goal of this arrest campaign? Who are Israeli forces, you know, particularly targeting? And if you could give us an idea of perhaps how many people have been arrested, how many Palestinian citizens of Israel have been arrested so far, if you have an idea on that.
Since the beginning of the assault on Gaza, since the 9th of May, we have witnessed a huge number of people being detained and arrested by the Israeli police during the protests that were held down in almost every Palestinian village, town, or city. These arrests that came from peaceful protests continued even after the ceasefire and even after the protests were stopped. The Israeli police declared after the ceasefire in Gaza that it would launch a campaign that the Israeli police called Law and Order, declared that one of the purposes of this arrest campaign is to settle the score with the Arab community, is to deter the Arab community to apply the law. First of all these goals of such an arrest campaign are illegal, even according to the Israeli law itself. The Israeli Supreme Court have decided in the past that using the arrest itself as means for deterrence is illegal. The goal of deterring people using the criminal law is being it should be done only after proving the accusations being brought against the detainee, not using his arrest as means to deter a whole society. This is cut clear a collective punishment by the Israeli police for the Palestinian citizens of Israel. During these 2 weeks of the arrest campaign, more than 2,400 people have been arrested, according to the official numbers of the police. 91% of the people arrested are Palestinian citizens of Israel. These numbers, these percentage, only 9% of the arrests are among Jewish people, tells the whole story that I was just telling. Such an arrest campaign is by no means is made to apply the law. The goals of such a campaign is cut clear, just to take revenge. The Israeli police have been subject to a lot of critiques recently, and they want to take revenge from the Arab society to maintain the Jewish supremacy in the state. We have witnessed arrests of minors from their homes, the way of the arrests also, the police breaking with huge forces to arrest a minor who's 14 years old, for example. They would come with four or five police cars, a force of 15 people, and take the minor from his home, from his family, after searching the whole house and breaking the properties, attacking the people inside the house, his parents, his families, for example. So also, the way that the Israeli police did these arrests is just to show, is a show, actually. It's a show to show its power. This is being understood by the Palestinians in 48, although it led to indictment lists against more than 200 people, but still the vast majority of people have been released after after their arrest, which also tells the story about how random these arrests are, that they have no legal basis or any basis at all. It's also the time to mention that the arrested people, the detainees, have been subject to a ill treatment inside of the police stations that also could amount to torture. We have witnessed in Adala, we have also gathered affidavits and testimonies from detainees that have been subject to brutal beatings inside of the police station by policemen, who also denied them the right to see an attorney, didn't inform their families. They didn't, people who required medical assistance, they denied them medical assistance. They made them forced them to sign on long home arrests as a condition to have medical attention. This ill treatment that we have witnessed inside of the police station was also part of a psychological warfare that we saw by the Israeli police against the Palestinian citizens, to spread such a feeling of terror from the police, to make people afraid to protest. But of course, this didn't succeed. We are still witnessing the same levels of unity, the same levels of hope that I have mentioned before. The arrest campaign came to an end a few days ago, but still there are more than 600 people still in custody. We hope that all of them will be released soon.
The arrest campaign, like you said, may, you know, have come to an end, and the protests may have sort of subsided for now. But something that you did mention earlier in our conversation was that there is this feeling that there has been a very sort of palpable, concrete change in the way that Palestinian citizens of Israel and are sort of dealing with their Palestinian identity. And for example, you mentioned the myth of coexistence and mixed cities sort of being broken. I want to ask, what is the feeling right now amongst Palestinian communities in Israel in the aftermath of, you know, of these sudden uprisings and then the subsequent arrest campaigns, you know, that we've seen over the past month? What are some of those permanent changes that you mentioned, you know, in your opinion, that have been made to Palestinian life inside Israel and the identity of Palestinians with Israeli citizenship?
Israel have always used the example of coexistence in mixed cities as a, I would say, propaganda tool. They would just spread all these illusions to the world, to reflect on, yani, to hide part of the story, or a huge part of the story. The coexistence in mixed cities, as the Israelis call, is actually have never been there. When we are talking about Lid, Akka, Yafa, Haifa, Ramli, and more, we are talking about Arabs being trapped in ghettos inside of the cities with no rights for housing, no rights for property and land. Their neighborhoods are never developed. They don't get the municipality services. So we are talking as a myth of coexistence that have been broken in the recent events. We are talking on such a huge level of racial difference between neighborhoods inside of these cities that would tell the whole story of the discrimination inside Israel. I think this will also reflect on other Palestinians living in their own towns and homes, not in the mixed cities, and how they view the Israeli modern life. The Tel Aviv example, I would say. This was a huge example for everyone who thought that Israel is seeking coexistence. That have been proven to be not true, that the Israeli state have always looked at Palestinian citizens of Israel as enemies, and they continue to look at them as enemies. Some of the changes I think that will happen after these events is restoring the sense of unity. Being part of events that took place in all of historic Palestine would leave its consequences on Palestinians in 48. These consequences will also take place on the political level. The demands for political representation as Palestinians, as part of people, should be there. We have witnessed recently that Palestinians in 48 have been sidelined by the BLO. And I think that this should change after the recent events.
You know, we've talked a lot about the hope and change and all the things that have sort of happened very rapidly over the past month. And I want to ask you sort of, where do you see things going forward in the near future when it comes to all the different forms of Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation, specifically within Palestinian communities inside of Israel? Do you think we're going to see more unity uprisings similar to the ones that we saw last month?
Today, the Israeli police decided to cancel the march of settlers inside the Jerusalem Old City and to the Aqsa Mosque, because it, as they described, it may lead to confrontations. This is a huge breakthrough after the recent uprising. Clearly, that what the police means by that it may lead to confrontations is that we should start thinking a lot more when we want to breach Al-Aqsa Mosque or any other mosque or city inside in Palestine. Yani, this event, this that I mentioned, is testifies by itself on where things are going. I think that the recent uprisings have set a new status quo that Netanyahu government in the recent years have been trying to break, the Palestinian spirit of defending their lands, their sacred places, and their lives. From that going on, I would say that any attack on Al-Aqsa or what we saw in Sheikh Jarrah, any provocations from the Israeli state or by settlers may, of course, lead to similar reactions from the Palestinians inside 48. These unity uprisings, they held the name unity for a reason. I think that reason is because they were united with all of Palestine. So the new status quo would say that any event that happened in any place in Palestine will have its echoes in all of Palestine, including 48.
Thank you, Wissam Sharaf, for joining us on the Mondawais podcast. And we appreciate you for taking the time to speak with us and share your insights on all the recent events that we've been seeing in Palestine. So thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of Mondawais.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics. Mondawais is a nonprofit publication, and every donation of any amount helps sustain our work.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. The ongoing Palestinian uprising against Israeli settler colonial rule across Palestine is being described as having begun in Sheikh Jarrah, the now well-known Palestinian neighborhood in Jerusalem facing ethnic cleansing. Now, it's a bit reductive to say that this is entirely the case because it ignores decades of attempts to mobilize and unify the Palestinian grassroots. Nonetheless, the Sheikh Jarrah campaign certainly has acted as a catalyst, and it has since captured, and it continues to capture, the hearts and minds of Palestinians because it really encapsulates the Palestinian experience, which is largely characterized by dispossession. Now, social media and the media in general has played a huge role in this mobilization, as we discussed in our last podcast episode. But in this episode, we want to focus on Sheikh Jarrah as the catalyst for this mobilizing and also discuss how it's become so emblematic for Palestinians everywhere. We are joined by Dr. Mona Dajani, an environmental researcher and an Ashabaka policy member who's also from Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. Mona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Yara, for having me.
Let's start with an introduction. What is happening in Sheikh Jarrah and why is it now that it has received so much attention?
Well, yeah, let's start with the basics. Sheikh Jarrah is a Palestinian neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem, of course, was occupied in 1967. Specifically, the Sheikh Jarrah that is making headlines in the news is a certain area of the neighborhood in Jauni, in Kerm Jauni. And Kerm Jauni hosts the Sheikh Jarrah housing compound, Wahdat al-Sheikh Jarrah, as we know them, where my grandparents' house is. And this specific neighborhood, this specific housing complex, was the home for 28 Palestinian families. These Palestinian families are refugee families that have found refuge in Sheikh Jarrah in 1956. Well, East Jerusalem at that time was under Hashemite Kingdom rule, and in collaboration with the UNRWA, the Relief Works Agency, these 28 families were given plots of land and a house in exchange of their refugee status, where they'll be kind of settled there after, you know, years of being refugees. My grandparents' family, for example, were refugees from Baqa neighborhood in what came to be known as West Jerusalem. They had to travel to Jordan and Syria, ending up back in Jerusalem in 1953 and being housed in Sheikh Jarrah. So this is the case for all the families. They come from different places in Palestine and they have been made refugees and expelled during the 1948, the Nakba, as is the story of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. So what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah? As you've mentioned in the introduction, what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah is not recent. It's not a decision made by a court just today. This has been a court case that has been filed against the residents and the families living in those houses since the 1970s. So after Israel occupied the rest of Palestine, in the 1970s, the residents of those houses started getting notices of lawsuits being filed against them by settler organizations claiming Jewish ownership of the land and wanting to basically expel all of these families to reclaim that land. And since the 70s, and we can imagine in the 1970s how Palestinians just overcoming the Nakba in 1948, then the Naksa in 1967. So you come to a very kind of disenfranchised, very weakened society that is facing a new lexicon, a new language, new regulations and policies by the Israeli settler state. Of course, you know, where laws are as equally important as infrastructures of violence as the actual destruction and depopulation of Palestinian villages. So they're facing a legal system here that they have no knowledge of. They have no understanding of how it works or how to actually confront it. And this is where the case began in the 1970s, where this legal battle started. And as we know now that the Israeli judicial system is so unjust and unfair, it's very far from being a court of justice. But anyways, against the Palestinians especially, these families have been undergoing appeal after appeal where the Israeli court is not taking into account the Palestinian proof of ownership of those houses based on the agreement that was signed between them and the Jordanian government at the time. Even evidence that the attorney that works with the families have been presenting from the Ottoman archives, from the Jordanian governments and so on, to prove ownership of Palestinians. But this type of evidence has been dismissed for years now, for decades, strengthening and standing also all the time with the side of the Israeli settlers. So what's happening today in Sheikh Jarrah is basically the last stage of this legal battle that the families have been going through, where the Israeli court has decided to rule, of course, for the settler organization called Nahalat Shim'on, and to start the process of expelling families. Started with four families in May. That was when the decision was to take place. And then through, you know, this great campaigning that happened on the ground, in addition to the relentless work of the lawyers, this case has been raised to the High Court or the Supreme Court of Israel to be seen by the general attorney. And this is the case where we've seen only a few days ago where the general attorney has refused to actually get involved in studying the case again and looking at the evidence again, which really leaves the families against the threat of expulsion that is more imminent.
And of course, one of the reasons that the general attorney didn't want to get involved is because it would politicize an issue, what the Israelis are calling a real estate case, which of course just completely whitewashes over the fact that this is colonial ethnic cleansing. And I think it's very important to note as well that the campaign against this ethnic cleansing in Sheikh Jarrah has been also ongoing for many years, but it was only recently that it attracted so much international attention. And I think one of the reasons for that is because of the youth involvement and the utilization of social media in such a new way in this case. Mona, I wanted to ask you a bit more about the other neighborhoods in Jerusalem facing similar struggles, because Sheikh Jarrah, of course, is not an exceptional case. This is also happening in neighborhoods like Silwan. So what does this tell us about the Israeli regime's plan for Greater Jerusalem?
I think every Jerusalemite lives with this burden of an existential burden and an existential threat to their presence in their own city on a daily basis. Since, of course, Israel's occupation in 1967, the fact that Jerusalem, the east part of Jerusalem, where the Palestinian neighborhoods are today, are under a reality of ongoing and continuing dispossession through different laws and regulations and mechanisms. So whether through these type of expulsions that are being orchestrated by the Israeli government through the help and support and the sanctioning of such settler organizations to take over Palestinian properties and homes, or whether through all of the different mechanisms and laws and regulations that Israel enacts in East Jerusalem of not allowing urban development and planning, the zoning limitations where Palestinians are not allowed to expand their built up areas, moving and forcing Palestinians to move outside of the limits and outside of the borders of the Jerusalem municipality, therefore risking revocation of their residencies. And this is really important to highlight here that Jerusalemites are mere residents in their own city. This also has a legal ramification where Israel also devises laws and regulations to ensure Palestinian presence in Jerusalem is very precarious in itself. You know, you have the center of life policy where Palestinians are forced to prove that they belong to the city, that their center of life is within those borders of East Jerusalem. So any attempt of any normal human being to look further than their birthplace for jobs, for education, to marry someone. All of these things are off limits to Jerusalemites. So we can really imagine this kind of reality where Palestinians are living. So as you mentioned, this is not only Sheikh Jarrah. As we are hearing also on the news, it's also the case of Batn al-Hawa in Silwan. And there also have been in this legal battle with the Israeli settler colonial state and the settler organization known there as Ateret Kohanim, which is another one of those state-sanctioned and U.S.-funded entities. So they're also facing another threat of expulsion there on the premise, again, of a real estate dispute and the fact that it's Jewish ownership of the land. However, we add to that another layer that it also is part of all of these, you know, settler organizations. Their main objective is to intensify its Jewish settler presence in the heart of Palestinian neighborhoods. It comes aligned with the Jerusalem municipality objective as well, is to ensure a demographic majority of Jews versus Palestinians in the city, to ensure a Jewish character of the city. These are all racist and supremacist way of controlling the space and controlling Palestinian spaces of existence that are, you know, of course, as we see, it's all sanctions. They're all funded and supported by the Israeli state. So Silwan, again, continues on with imminent threat of expulsion, only and also because they want to ensure a biblical character of the area, where they are intending to also develop the city of David, biblical park, on the rubble of those Palestinian homes. We've also seen how, you know, Palestinians have been getting notices for home demolitions in the Silwan as well. And this is also part and parcel of policy of dispossession that Israel carries out, and the fact that your existence on the land is in itself seen as a threat. What we can also say here, these also have very material implications on Palestinians' lives within the city. Palestinians have no other place to go. If we think of Palestinians' families in Sheikh Jarrah or Silwan, you know, the threat of expulsion is so real. But what happens also the day after? Do we also understand that this is a systematic reality for Palestinians where we have nowhere else to go? And I think this is really important to understand, especially for people who kind of think of it or like frame it as a real estate issue, is that sidetracks the very exclusionary nature and the systematic dispossession that Palestinians have been going through in Jerusalem for decades. And the whole objective of it is to empty Jerusalem from its Palestinian residents, to really destroy the social fabric, the cultural and political institutions and infrastructures that Palestinians in Jerusalem have built and developed for decades. And we've seen that, how just quickly the Israeli forces brutally attack Palestinian protesters, whether in Sheikh Jarrah, in Al-Aqsa Mosque, whether people also just sitting in Damascus Gate. We've seen, like, only recently, 2 days ago, how the skunk water machines were spraying neighborhoods in Silwan. They were spraying the Damascus Gate sitting area. So in addition, of course, of all the brutal attacks that happen against the Palestinian protesters, as we've seen through the skunk truck or the grenades or the brutal attacks that we've seen against Palestinians.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
And of course, in Jerusalem, this maintaining of Israeli Jewish dominance is incredibly intense and aggressive. But it also happens across colonized Palestine. And so, you know, what happens in Sheikh Jarrah has to be framed within this wider context of Israeli settler colonization of Palestine. And so I think this is why Sheikh Jarrah has become so emblematic for Palestinians, for all Palestinians, because displacement is a key part of Palestinian experience, whether you are in Haifa, Nazareth, Yaffa, Beita in the West Bank, or anywhere else for that matter.
It is definitely a case where Palestinians all across Palestine, as you've mentioned, are experiencing the same apparatus and the same mechanisms of dispossession. If we talk only about expulsions from homes based on these false claims of ownership and, you know, these false claims of Palestinians being mere tenants in their own homes, we've seen that happening in different cities. We've seen that once the Sheikh Jarrah movement and the Safe Sheikh Jarrah mobilization started taking shape, that lots of Palestinians said, this is happening in Yaffa, this is happening in Lid, this is happening in Akko. The same mechanisms have been used by the settler colonial state against Palestinians, wherever they are, whatever the political realities are for those Palestinians, and whether these Palestinians have Israeli citizenship or whether you are a mere resident in Jerusalem or whether you're a Palestinian ID holder in the West Bank in Gaza, we are all Palestinians facing the same methods of dispossession everywhere. And this is why I think the Sheikh Jarrah case has been so unifying for Palestinians everywhere, because I think a lot of commentators and a lot of people and the residents themselves describe it as an ongoing Nakba. And I think this is why all Palestinians have witnessed through their live feeds what the youth of Sheikh Jarrah, especially Muhammad and Muna and many others who were on the ground sharing live footage of what type of brutality they're facing from the settlers and from the Israeli soldiers and police. And everybody saw in it kind of their own dispossession, their own stories of Nakba, of their parents and grandparents. So Sheikh Jarrah actually, in a way, describes and symbolizes that experience. So I think this is why we see it being also shared so widely. And the fact that Palestinians from all over the spectrum, even Palestinians in the diaspora, as we've seen, are saying no more. Like, we are going to act this time around, because this is another existential threat to not only our existence on the land, but our memory of the place and our future in this place. So I think it kind of really is such a strong case. And I think what's really interesting is that how kind of it linked so easily and so smoothly to what's happening in Silwan, what Palestinians in Naqab, in the Galilee, in the West Bank, and in Gaza. We're all in this together. So this is, I think, what kind of unified more and more the Palestinian case and the Palestinian experience. I always say, like, you know, my grandparents' house in Sheikh Jarrah, it's not the most beautiful house or property in the world. But I think, of course, it's the symbolism of those places and what they mean. And the fact that they all symbolize, like Sheikh Jarrah symbolizes how refugees managed to exercise some form of return by establishing roots again in a place in Palestine and calling it home, only to be under the threat of losing that refuge and that place only a few years after moving into it and feeling like, oh, you know, we can actually build our lives again. And this is, I think, also what makes the Sheikh Jarrah story so powerful and how it resonates with all Palestinians.
Now, of course, Palestinians are not passive amidst settler colonial erasure and this kind of ethnic cleansing, and they resist in multiple ways, which we'll touch upon in a little bit. But I want to ask a question that a lot of people outside of Palestine ask, and that is, why do Palestinians use Israeli legal courts at all, especially considering that they are illegitimate even by international law? And as you yourself mentioned, the entire system is inherently unjust.
I think this is such an important question. We need to clarify why and how Palestinians engage with Israeli institutions. Just to highlight that Palestinians have been forced to engage with Israeli institutions since 1948, since the Nakba. There have also been cases where Palestinians have refused to engage with Israeli institutions. In Jerusalem specifically, I'll give two quick examples. Jerusalemites have collectively refused to participate in Israeli municipal elections. And another form of disengagement or refusal has been to collectively refuse as well to apply for Israeli citizenship. However, you know, Palestinians engaged with the Israeli court system. And simply, I think, because they had no other choice, other alternative, but to engage. If we take the case of Sheikh Jarrah, the families, only a few years after the Israeli occupation in 1967, were handed these letters stating that lawsuits have been filed against them by the settler organization. At that moment in time, they had no choice but to go to court to present their case.
knowing on one hand that their case is just, that they have ample evidence to prove their rightful ownership of the land and houses that they live in. But on the other hand, of course, Palestinian Jerusalemites and the families knew that this Israeli court system is inherently biased, is inherently racist and exclusionary of Palestinians. And it's part and parcel of an Israeli system that aims to dispossess them of their land, of their homes, and to eliminate their presence from the city. So this has been, you know, the greatest dilemma of engaging with these systems. However, today we see that there are new tools and avenues that are opening up for Palestinians to use to fight and seek justice against their dispossession. One of which is what the Sheikh Jarrah families did was to submit a letter in April 2021 to the Office of the Persecutor of the ICC, of the International Criminal Court, calling for the inclusion of their case, of the Sheikh Jarrah expulsion case, as part of the open investigation that's happening on the situation in Palestine. I think this is also a new avenue that Palestinians are seeking to overcome this very racist and exclusionary avenues that have been used for decades.
So what I think is that for a lot of Palestinians who do engage with the Israeli legal system in these cases is that they view it as one tool in a toolbox of many tools. And it's not that they expect justice from this system, but really it's a way to slow down what a lot of people fear is the inevitable, which in this case is the total Judaization of Jerusalem. So I don't think Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah or elsewhere really expect much from these courts, but it is, you know, a way or a path that some people choose in a hope that it buys them time whilst they engage in other forms of resistance. And I really think overall the expectations from Palestinians is very, very low when it comes to Israeli courts.
You're right. And I think also the fact that after 1948, what happened throughout Palestine, especially with Palestinians inside Israel, learning, you know, the hard way about Israeli law and how Israel uses it to dispossess and to Judaize and all of that, there has been kind of some legal advice that has been passed around between Palestinians occupied in the West Bank and Jerusalem, and also the occupied Golan Heights, where legal advice was shared about how can you actually access those legal ways and legal methods, and how do you actually use them to protect your land, to protect your houses from being demolished, or protect your land from being confiscated and so on. So I think there's also been like a very long legacy of Palestinians supporting each other legally in to kind of really understand those institutions and try to find entry points through which to seek justice. But I do agree that these institutions and these mechanisms will not bring justice for Palestinians. But under conditions of a belligerent occupation, a decades-long occupation and settler colonialism, it's really difficult to kind of to break away from engaging with and confronting the Israeli institutions and to try to seek justice through that confrontation. But as you mentioned, it's also in addition to solidifying and making sure that there are other ways of resisting and other ways of bringing justice against the cases of ongoing settlement expansion or house demolitions or house expulsions. So this is the reality. This is a decades long occupation. We needed to kind of engage with those institutions. And this kind of really opens up that there are so many other ways of resisting that Palestinians in Jerusalem have attempted to do.
Mona, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Yara. Thank you so much.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Quebec, vaccination against COVID-19 is underway. But not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow all the health guidelines, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec. Broadcast program.
We're going to call you CKUP. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what.
You should come and build with me. I think we should link. We can chill, we can do what you like. We can link, we can build, we can talk, we can chill, we can do what you like. Yeah, never do my city, queen of the block. Yeah, I can make it stack, it won't ever drop. Creating something special, orange, green, and yellow, purple, red. Building up an empire, taking over the entire world. So many pieces, leave them all speechless. You can never teach this, on to each is. Imagination, get your education, build your foundation, want a future, make one. We can link, we can build, we can talk, we can chill, we can do what you like. We can link, we can build, we can talk, we can chill, we can do what you like. You should come and build with.